The sun was setting before Polly found Jackram again, and blood-red light shone through the high windows of the keep's biggest kitchen. He was sitting alone at a long table by the fire in full uniform, and he was eating a thick slab of bread plastered with pork dripping. A mug of beer was not far from his other hand. Jackram looked up as she approached and nodded companionably toward another chair. Around them, women ran to and fro. "Pork dripping with salt and pepper and a mug of beer," he said. "That's the ticket. You can keep your cuisine. Want a slice?" He waved a hand at one of the kitchen girls who was dancing attendance on him.
"Not right now, Sarge."
"Sure," said Jackram. "There's an old saying, kissing don't last, cooking do. I hope that it's one you don't have cause to reflect upon." Polly sat down.
"Kissing is lasting so far," she said.
"Shufti gets sorted out," said Jackram. He finished the beer, snapped his fingers at the serving girl, and pointed to the empty mug.
"To her own satisfaction, Sarge," said Polly.
"Fair enough. You can't get fairer. So what next, Perks?"
"Dunno, Sarge. I'll go with Alice and the army, and see what happens."
"Best of luck. Look after them, Perks, 'cause I ain't coming," said Jackram.
"Sarge?" said Polly, shocked.
"Well, looks like we're going to be short by one war at present, eh? Anyway, this is it. The end of the road. I've done my bit. Can't go on now. Shot me quiver with the general, I dare say he, will be glad to see the back of me. Besides, old age is creeping on. I killed 5 poor devils when we attacked today, and afterwards I found myself wondering why. Not good, that. Time to get out before I blunt me own edge."
"You're sure, Sarge?"
"Yeah. Seems to me the old my country right or wrong thing is at its day. Time to put my feet up and find out what it is we've been fighting for. Sure you won't have any dripping? It's got crunchy bits. That's what I call style in dripping."
Polly waved away the proffered slab of grease-smeared bread and sat in silence while Jackram engulfed it. "Funny thing, really," she said at last.
"What's that, Perks?"
"Finding out that it's not about you. You think you're the hero, and it turns out you're really part of someone else's story. Was Alice will be the one they remember. We just had to get her here." Jackram said nothing, but, as Polly would have predicted, pulled his crumpled bag of chewing tobacco out of his pocket. She slipped a hand in her own pocket and pulled out a small packet. Pockets, she thought. We've got to hang on to pockets. A soldier needs pockets. "Try this, Sarge," she said. "Go on, open it." It was a small, soft leather pouch with a drawstring. Jackram held it up so that it twisted this way and that.
"Well, Perks, upon my oath, I am not a swearing man," he began.
"No, you're not. I've noticed," said Polly. "But that grubby old paper was getting on my nerves. Why didn't you ever get a proper pouch made for yourself? One of the saddlers here sewed that up for me in half an hour."
"Well, that's life, isn't it?" said Jackram. "Every day you think, ye gods, it's about time I had a new bag. But then it gets all so busy you end up using the old one. Thank you, Perks."
"Oh, I thought, what can I give the man who has everything? And that was all I could afford," said Polly. "But you don't have everything, Sarge." "Sarge, you don't, do you?" She sensed him freeze over. The noises of the kitchen went away beyond a dome of frigid silence.
"You stop right there, Perks," he said, lowering his voice.
"I just thought you might like to show someone that locket of yours, Sarge," said Polly cheerfully. "The one round your neck. And don't glare at me, Sarge. Oh, yeah, I could walk away, and I'd never be sure, really sure, and maybe you'd never show it to anyone else ever, or tell them the story. And one day we'll both be dead, and, well, what a waste, eh?" Jackram glared. "Upon your oath, you are not a dishonest man," said Polly. "Good one, Sarge. You tell people every day." Around them, beyond the dome, the kitchen buzzed with the busyness of women. Women always seemed to be doing things with their hands, holding babies or pans or plates or wool or a brush or a needle. Even when they were talking, busyness was happening.
"No one would believe you," said Jackram at last.
"Who would I want to tell?" said Polly. "And you're right. No one would believe me. I'd believe you, though." Jackram stared into his fresh mug of beer, as if trying to see the future in the foam. He seemed to reach a decision, pulled the chain out of his noisome undershirt, unfastened the locket, and gently snapped it open.
"There you go," he said, passing it across. "Much good may it do you."
There was a miniature painting in each side of the locket. A dark-haired girl, and a blonde young man in the uniform of the Ins and Outs.
"Good one of you," said Polly.
"Pull the other one. It has got bells on," said Jackram.
"No, honestly," said Polly.
"I look at the picture and look at you, and I can see that face in her face. Paler, of course. Not so full.
And who was the boy?"
"William, his name was," said Jackram.
"Your sweetheart?"
"Yes."
"And you followed him into the army?"
"Oh, yes, same old story. I was a big, strong girl, and, well, you can see the picture. The artist did his best, but I was never an oil painting. Barely a watercolour, really. Where I came from, what a man looked for in a future wife was someone who could lift a pig under each arm. And a couple of days later, I was lifting a pig under each arm, helping my dad, and one of my clogs came off in the muck, and the old man was yelling at me, and I thought, 'The hell with this!' Willie never yelled. Got hold of some men's clothes, never you mind how. Cut my hair right off, kissed the Duchess, and was a chosen man within 3 months."
"What's that?"
"It's what we used to call a corporal," said Jackram. "Chosen man. Yeah, I smiled about that too. And I was on my way. The army's a piece of piss compared to running a pig farm and looking after 3 lazy brothers."
"How long ago was that, Sarge?"
"Couldn't say, really. I swear I don't know how old I am, and that's the truth," said Jackram. "Lied about my age so often I ended up believing me."
She began, very carefully, to transfer the chewing tobacco into the new bag. "And you're a young man," said Polly quietly.
"Oh, we had great times, great times," said Jackram, stopping for a moment to stare at nothing. "He never got promoted on account of his stutter, but I had a good shouty voice and officers liked that. But Willie never minded, not even when I made it to sergeant. And then he got killed at Seppel, right next to me."
"I'm sorry."
"You don't have to be, you didn't kill him," said Jackram evenly. "But I stepped over his body and skewered the bugger that did. Wasn't his fault. Wasn't my fault. We were soldiers. Then a few months later, I had a bit of a surprise, and he was called William too, just like his father. Good job I had a bit of leave, eh? Me gran raised him for me, put him to a trade as an armourer over in Scritts. Good trade, that. No one kills a good armourer. They tell me he looks just like his dad. A captain I met once had bought a bloody good sword off him. Showed it to me, not knowing the history, of course. Damn good sword. It had scroll work on the hilt and everything, very classy. He's married with 4 kids now, I heard. Got a carriage and pair, servants, big house. Yeah, I see you're paying attention."
Wasser and the Duchess said...
Yeah, they talked about Scritts and a sword," said Jackram. "That's when I knew it wasn't just me watching over you lads. I knew you'd survive. The old girl needed you."
"So you've got to go there, Sarge," said Polly.
"Got to? Who says? I served the old girl the whole of my life, and she's got no call on me now. I'm my own man, always have been."
"Are you, Sarge?" said Polly.
"Are you crying, Perks?"
"Well, it's a bit sad, Sarge."
"Oh, I dare say I sobbed a bit too once in a while," said Jackram, still tucking the tobacco into the new pouch. "But when all's said and done, I've had a good life. Saw the cavalry break at the Battle of Slomp. I was part of the thin red line that turned aside the heavy brigade at Sheep's Drift. I saved the Imperial flag from 4 real bastards at Raladan, and I've been to a lot of foreign countries and met some very interesting people, who I mostly subsequently killed before they could do me over good and proper. Lost a lover, still got a son. There's many a woman who's faced worse, believe me."
"And you spotted other girls?"
"Ha! Became a kind of hobby, really. Most of them were frightened little things running away from God knows what. They got found out soon enough. And there were plenty like Shufti chasing their lad. But there were a few who had what I call the twinkle. A bit of fire, maybe. They just needed pointing in the right direction. I gave them a leg up, you might say. A sergeant's a powerful man sometimes. A word here, a nod there. Sometimes even doctoring some paperwork. A whisper in the dark."
"A pair of socks," said Polly.
"Yeah, that sort of thing," said Jackram, grinning. "Always a big concern to them, the whole latrine business. Least of your worries, I used to say. In peace, no one cares. In battle, everyone takes a piss the same way, and damn quickly, too. Oh, I helped them. I was their what's-it, their Eminence Grease. And grease it was, too, sliding them to the top. Jackram's little lads, I called them."
"And they never suspected?"
"What? Suspect jolly Jack Jackram, so full of rum and vinegar?" said Jackram, the old evil grin coming back. Jack Jackram who could stop a bar fight by belching? No, sir. I dare say some of them suspected something, maybe. I dare say they worked out there was something going on somewhere. But I was just the big fat sergeant who knew everyone and everything and drank everything, too. Polly dabbed at her eyes.
What are you going to do now, then, if you don't go to Scritts?
Oh, I've got a bit put by, said Jackram. More than a bit, in point of actual fact. Pillage, plunder, loot, it all adds up, whatever you call it. I didn't piss it all up against a wall like the other lads, right? I expect I can remember most of the bleeding places I buried it. Always thought I might open an inn or maybe a knocking shop. Oh, a proper high-class place. You don't have to look at me like that. Nothing like that stinking tent. No, I'm talking about one with a chef and chandeliers and a lot of red velvet, very exclusive. I'd get some knobby lady to front it, and I'd be the bouncer and run the bar. Here's a tip, lad, for your future career, and it's one some of the other little lads learn for themselves. Sometimes it'll help if you visit one of them naughty places, otherwise the men'll wonder about you. I always used to take a book to read and advise the young lady to get some sleep, because it does a tough job. Polly let that pass, but she said, "You don't want to go back and see your grandchildren?"
"Wouldn't wish myself on him, lad," said Jackram firmly. "Wouldn't dare. My boy's a well-respected man in the town. What have I got to offer? He'll not want some fat old biddy banging on his back door and gobbing baccy juice all over the place and telling him she's his mother."
Polly looked at the fire for a moment and felt the idea creep into her mind. "What about a distinguished-looking sergeant-major, shiny with braid, loaded with medals, arriving at the front door in a grand coach and telling him he's his father?" she said. Jackram stared. "Tides of war and all that?" Polly went on, mind suddenly racing. "Young love, duty calls, families scattered, hopeless searching, decades pass, fond memories. Then, oh, an overheard conversation in a bar, yeah, that'd work. Hope springs, a new search, greasing palms, the recollections of old women, at last, an address.
What are you saying, Perks?"
"You're a liar, Sarge," said Polly, leaning forward. "Best I've ever heard. One last lie pays for all. Why not? You could show him the locket. You could tell him about the girl you left behind you."
Jackram looked away, but said, "You're a shining bastard of a thinker, Perks. And where would I get a grand coach anyway?"
"Oh, Sarge, today? There are men in high places who'll give you anything you ask for right now, you know that. Especially if it meant they'd see the back of you. You never put the bite on them for anything much. If I was you, Sarge, I'd cash in a few favours while you can. That's the ins and outs, Sarge. Take the cheese while it's there, because kissing don't last."
Jackram took a deep, long breath. "I'll think about it, Perks. Now you push off, all right?"
Polly stood up. "Think hard, Sarge, eh? Like you said, anyone who's got anyone left is ahead of the game right now. For a grandchildren. I'd be a proud kid if I had a grandad who could spit tobacco juice far enough to hit a fly on the opposite wall."
"I'm warning you, Perks."
"It was just a thought, Sarge."
"Yeah, right," Jackram growled.
"Thanks for getting us through it, Sarge."
Jackram didn't turn round.
"I'll be going then, Sarge."
"Perks,"
said Jackram as she reached the door. Polly stepped back into the room. "Yes, Sarge."
"I expected better of 'em, really. I thought they'd be better at it than men. Trouble was, they were better than men at being like men. They do say the army can make a man of you, eh? So whatever it is you are going to do next, do it as you. Good or bad, do it as you. Too many lies, and there's no truth to go back to."
"Will do, Sarge."
"That's an order, Perks." "Owen Perks."
"Yes, Sarge."
"Thanks, Perks."
Polly paused when she got to the door. Jackram had turned her chair to the fire and settled back. Around her, the kitchen worked. 6 months passed. The world wasn't perfect, but it was still turning. Polly had kept the newspaper articles. They weren't accurate, not in the detail, because the writer told stories, not what was actually happening. They were like paintings, when you had been there and had seen the real thing. But it was true about the march on the castle, with Wazza on a white horse in front carrying a flag. And it was true about people coming out of their houses and joining the march, so that what arrived at the gates was not an army but a sort of disciplined mob, shouting and cheering.
And it was true that the guards had taken one look at it and had seriously reconsidered their future, and that gates had swung open even before the horse had clattered onto the drawbridge. There was no fighting, no fighting at all. The shoe had dropped. The country had breathed out. Polly didn't think it was true that the painting of the Duchess, alone on its easel in the big, empty throne room, had smiled when Wazza walked toward it. Polly had been there and didn't see, but lots of people swore it had, and you might end up wondering what the truth really was, or whether there was the truth. And then again, if there was also the truth, and of course, the truth. Anyway, it was the stuff of legends, where accuracy is not required as a major ingredient. Anyway, it had worked. And then they went home. A lot of soldiers did, under the fragile truce. The first snows were already falling, and if people had wanted a war, then the winter had given them one. It came with lances of ice and arrows of hunger. It filled the passes with snow. It made the world as distant as the moon. That was when the old dwarf mines had opened up, and pony after pony emerged. It had always been said there were dwarf tunnels everywhere, and not just tunnels. There were secret canals under the mountains, docks, flights of locks that could lift a barge a mile high in busy darkness, far below the gales on the mountaintops. They brought, indeed, cabbage and potatoes and roots and apples and barrels of fat, things that kept. And the winter was defeated, and the snow melt roared down the valleys, and the Kinnock scrawled its random wiggles across the flat silt of the valley. They'd gone home, and Polly wondered if they'd ever really been away. Were we soldiers, she wondered? They'd been cheered on the road to Prince Marmaduke Pyotr Albert Hans Josef Bernhard Wilhelmsburg, and had been much better treated than their rank deserved, and even had a special uniform designed for them. But the vision of Gummy Abbins kept arising in her mind. "We weren't soldiers," she decided. "We were girls in uniform. We were like a lucky charm. We were mascots. We weren't real. We were always a symbol of something. We'd done very well for women. And we were temporary." Tonka and Lofty were never going to be dragged back to the school now, and they'd gone their own way. Wazza had joined the general's household and had a room of her own and quietness, and made herself useful and was never beaten. She'd written Polly a letter in tiny, spiky handwriting. She seemed happy. A world without beatings was heaven. Jade and her beau had wandered off to do something more interesting, as trolls very sensibly did. Shufti had been on a timetable of her own. Maledicta had disappeared, and Igorina, at least, had set up by herself in the capital, dealing with women's problems, or at least those women's problems that weren't men. And senior officers had given them medals and watched them go with fixed, faint smiles. Kisses don't last. And now, it wasn't that good things were happening, it was just that bad things had stopped. The old women still grumbled, but they were left to grumble. No one had any directions, no one had a map, no one was quite certain who was in charge. There were arguments and debates on every street corner. It was frightening and exhilarating. Every day was an exploration. Polly had worn a pair of Paul's old pants to clean the floor of the big bar and had got barely a harumph from anyone. Owen, the girls' working school, had burned down, and on the same day, two slim masked figures had robbed a bank. Polly had grinned when she heard that, and hoped that Tonka and Lofty would one day find a way to eat chocolates in a great big room where the world was a different place. Shufti, who'd somehow always be Shufti to Polly, even if the rest of the world now called her Betty again, had moved into the Duchess. Her baby was called Jack. Paul doted on it. And now, someone had been drawing in the gents' privy again. Polly couldn't wash it off, so she contented herself with correcting the anatomy. Then she swooshed the place clean, at least by pub urinal standards, with a couple of buckets, and ticked off the chore, just as she did every morning. When she arrived back in the bar, there were a group of worried men there talking to her father. They looked mildly frightened when she strode in. "What's happening?" she said. Her father nodded to Gummy Abbins, and everyone stepped back a little. What with the spittle and the bad breath, you never wanted a conversation with Gummy to be particularly intimate.
"The Swede eaters is at it again," he said. "They're going to invade, 'cause the prince says we belong to him now."
"'It's all down to him being the Duchess's distant cousin,' said Polly's father.
"'But I heard it still wasn't settled,' said Polly. "'Anyway, there's still a truce.'
"'Seems like he's settling it,' said Gummy.
The rest of the day passed at an accelerated pace. There were groups of people talking urgently in the streets, and a crowd around the gates to the town hall. Every so often a clerk would come out and nail another communique on the gates. The crowd would close over it like a hand, open again like a flower. Polly elbowed her way to the front, ignoring the mutterings around her, and scanned the sheets. Same old stuff. They were recruiting again. The same old words, the same old croakings of long-dead soldiers inviting the living to join them. General Frock might be female, but he was also, as Blouse would have said, a bit of an old woman. Either that, or the heaviness of those epaulettes had weighed her down. Kissing don't last. Oh, the Duchess had come alive before them and turned the world upside down for a spell, and maybe they had all decided to be better people, and out of certain oblivion had come a space to breathe. And then, had it really happened? Even Polly sometimes wondered, and she had been there. Was it just a voice in their heads? Some kind of hallucination? Weren't soldiers in desperate straits famous for seeing visions of gods and angels? And somewhere in the course of the long winter, the miracle had faded, and people had said, "Yep, but we've got to be practical." All we were given was a chance, thought Polly. No miracle, no rescue, no magic, just a chance. She walked back to the inn, her mind buzzing. When she got there, a package was waiting. It was quite long and heavy.
"It came all the way from Scritz on the cart," said Shufti excitedly.
She'd been working in the kitchen. It had become, now, her kitchen.
"I wonder what it can be," she said pointedly.
Polly levered the lid off the rough wooden crate and found that it was full of straw with an envelope lying on top of it. She opened it. Inside was an iconograph. It looked expensively done, a stiff family group with curtains and a potted palm in the background to give everything a bit of style. On the left was a middle-aged man looking proud. On the right was a woman of about the same age, looking rather puzzled, but nevertheless pleased because her husband was happy. And here and there, staring at the viewer with variations of smile and squint and expressions that ran from interest to a sudden recollection that they should have gone to the toilet before posing, were children, ranging from tall and gangly to small and smugly sweet. And, sitting on a chair in the middle, the focus of it all was Sergeant Jackram, shining like the sun. Polly stared and then turned the picture over. On the back was written, in big black letters, "S. M. Jackram's Last Stand," and underneath, "Don't need these." She smiled and pulled aside the straw. In the middle of the box, wrapped in cloth, were a couple of cutlasses.
"Is that old Jackram?" said Shufti, picking up the picture.
"Yes, he's found his son," said Polly, unwinding a blade.
Shufti shuddered when she saw it.
"Evil things," she said.
"Things, anyway," said Polly.
She laid both the cutlasses on the table and was about to lift the box out of the way when she saw something small in the straw at the bottom. It was oblong and wrapped in thin leather. It was a notebook with a cheap binding and musty yellowing pages.
"What's that?" said Shufti.
"I think it's his address book," said Polly, flicking through the pages. "This is it," she thought. "It's all here. Generals and majors and captains, oh my. There must be hundreds, maybe a thousand. Names, real names, promotions, dates, everything."
She pulled out a white pasteboard rectangle that had been inserted like a bookmark. It showed a rather florid coat of arms and bore the printed legend, "William de Word, Editor, The Times of Ankh-Morpork. The truth shall make ye frep. Gleam Street, Ankh-Morpork, C-mail, wdw@times.am. Someone had crossed out the P in frep and pencilled in an E above it. It was a sudden strange fancy.
How many ways can you fight a war, Polly wondered. We have the clacks now. I know a man who writes things down. The world turns. Plucky little countries seeking self-determination. Could be useful to big countries with plans of their own.
Time to grab the cheese. Polly's expression as she stared at the wall would have frightened a number of important people. They would have been even more concerned about the fact that she spent the next several hours writing things down, because it occurred to Polly that General Frock had not got where she was today by being stupid, and therefore she could profit from following her example. She copied out the entire notebook and sealed it in an old jam jar, which she hid in the roof of the stables. She wrote a few letters, and she got her uniform out of the wardrobe and inspected it critically. The uniforms that had been made for them had a special additional quality that could only be called girly. They had more braid, they were better tailored, and they had a long skirt with a bustle rather than pants. The shakos had plumes too. Her tunic had a sergeant's stripes. It had been a joke. A sergeant of women. The world had been turned upside down after all. They'd been mascots, good luck charms, and, perhaps, on the march to Prince Marmaduke Piotr Albert Hans Josef Bernhard Wilhelmsburg, a joke was what everyone needed. But maybe, when the world turns upside down, you can turn a joke upside down too. Thank you, Gummy, even though you didn't know what it was you were teaching me. When they're laughing at you, their guard is down. When their guard is down, you can kick them in the fracas. She examined herself in the mirror. Her hair, now, was just long enough to be a nuisance without being long enough to be attractive, so she brushed it and left it at that. She put the uniform on, but with the skirt over her pants, and tried to put aside the nagging feeling that she was dressing up as a woman. There. She looked completely harmless. She looked slightly less harmless with both cutlasses and one of the horse bows on her back, especially if you knew that the inn's dartboards now all had deep holes in the bullseyes from all the practising. She crept along the hall to the window that overlooked the inn yard. Paul was up a ladder, repainting the sign. Her father was steadying the ladder and calling out instructions in his normal way, which was to call out the instruction just a second or two after you'd already started doing something. And Shufti was watching them, holding Jack. It made a lovely picture. For a moment, she wished she had a locket. The Duchess was smaller than she'd thought. But if you had to protect it by standing in the doorway with a sword, you were too late. Caring for small things had to start with caring for big things, and maybe the world wasn't big enough. The note she left on her dressing table read, "Shufti, I hope you and Jack are happy here. Paul, you look after her. Dad, I've never taken any wages, but I need a horse. I'll try to have it sent back. I love you all. If I don't come back, burn this letter and look in the roof of the stables." She dropped out of the window, saddled up a horse in the stables, and let herself out of the back gate. She didn't mount up until she was out of earshot, and then rode down to the river. Spring was pouring through the country. Sap was rising. In the woods, a ton of timber was growing every minute. Everywhere, birds were singing. There was a guard on the ferry. He eyed her nervously as she led the horse aboard, and then grinned when he saw what he thought were stripes that didn't really mean much. "Morning, miss," he said cheerfully. "Well, time to start." Polly marched in front of the puzzled man. "Are you trying to be smart?" she demanded, inches from his face. "No, miss." "That's Sergeant, mister," said Polly. "Let's try again, shall we? I said, are you trying to be smart?" "No, Sergeant." Polly leaned until her nose was an inch from his. "Why not?" The grin faded. This was not a soldier on the fast track to promotion. "Huh?" he managed. "If you are not trying to be smart, mister, you're happy to be stupid," shouted Polly. "And I'm up to here with stupid, understand?" "Yeah, but..." "But what, soldier?" "Yeah, but... well, but nothing, sergeant," said the soldier. "That's good," Polly nodded at the ferryman. "Time to go," she suggested, but in the tones of an order. "Couple of people just coming down the road, sergeant," said one of them, a faster man with an uptake. They waited. They were, in fact, three people. One of them was Maledicta, in full female uniform. Polly said nothing until the ferry was out in midstream. The vampire gave her the kind of smile only a vampire can give. It would have been sheepish if sheep had different teeth. "Thought I'd try again," she said. "We'll find Blouse," said Polly. "He's a major now," said Maledicta, "'and happy as a flea because they've named a kind of fingerless glove after him, I heard. "'What do we want him for?'
"'He knows about the clacks. "'He knows about other ways war can be fought, with intelligence for one thing. "'And I know people,' said Polly.
"'Ah, do you mean the upon my oath I am not a lying man, but I know people kind of people?'
"'Those were the kind of people I had in mind, yes.'
The river slapped against the side of the ferry.
"'Good,' said Maledicta.
"'I don't know where it's going to lead, though,' said Polly.
"'Ah, even better.'
At which point, Polly decided that she knew enough of the truth to be going on with. The enemy wasn't men, or women, or the old, or even the dead. It was just bleeding stupid people, who came in all varieties, and no one had the right to be stupid. She looked at the other two passengers who'd sidled aboard. They were country lads in ragged, ill-fitting clothes, keeping away from her and staring intently at the deck. But one glance was enough. The world turned upside down, and history repeated itself. For some reason, that suddenly made her feel very happy.
"'Going to join up, lads?' she said cheerily. There was some mumbling on the theme of yes.
"'Good. Then stand up straight,' said Polly. "'Let's have a look at you. Chins up.
Ah, well done. Shame you didn't practice walking in pants, and I noticed you didn't bring an extra pair of socks.'
They stared, mouths open.
"'What are your names?' said Polly. "'Your real names, please. Don't look so worried. You can tell me the truth. And don't try cunning on me, because I was trained by Mr. Fox.'
"'Rosemary,' one of them began. "'I'm Mary,' said the other. "'I heard girls were joining, but everyone laughed, so I thought I'd better pretend to—'
"'Oh, you can join as men if you want,' said Polly. The girls looked at one another.
"'You get better swear words,' said Polly. "'And the pants are useful, but it's your choice.'
"'A choice?' said Rosemary.
"'Certainly,' said Polly. She put a hand on a shoulder of each girl, winked at Maledicta, and added, "'You are my little lads, or not, as the case may be, and I will look after you.'
And the new day was a great big fish.
That is the end of Monstrous Regiment. It was written by Terry Pratchett and read by Stephen Briggs. This has been an ISIS Audiobooks presentation. For further details of our extensive catalogue of audiobooks on cassette and CD, please call our free phone number, which is 0800 731 5637.